continuing with the suttas on just on the five hindrances, just as a kind of a recap, and on the section on ill will, there's a few short suttas that there was one that I was thinking of, and then when I was trying to find it, then I came across a couple more that I couldn't resist bringing to mind. So it's ill will, aversion. The first, there's two that are sort of back to back, Anguttara Fives, 161, and then 162. The first one, bhikkhus, there are these five ways of removing resentment by which a bhikkhu should entirely remove resentment when it has arisen toward anyone. What five? One should develop loving kindness for the person one resents. In this way, one should remove the resentment toward that person. Two, one should develop compassion for the person one resents. In this way, one should remove the resentment toward that person. Three, one should develop equanimity toward the person one resents. In this way, one should remove the resentment toward that person. Four, one should disregard the person one resents and pay no attention to him. In this way, one should remove the resentment toward that person. Five, one should apply the idea of the ownership of kamma to the person one resents thus. This venerable one is the owner of his kamma, the heir of his kamma, that he has kamma as his origin, kamma as his relative, kamma as his resort. He will be the heir of any kamma he does, good or bad. In this way, one should remove the resentment toward that person. These are the five ways of removing resentment by which a bhikkhu should entirely remove resentment when it has arisen toward anyone. So this is just practical advice in terms of dealing with ill will, aversion, resentment. What's notable is that one doesn't need to develop mudita towards that person. This is loving kindness, compassion, equanimity. But the mudita doesn't actually work. So that disregarding and an equanimity. Any questions? Yeah.
Disregard.
Well, I think just not get, disregard, ignore, not dwell on. I mean, there's probably not to dwell on the person. I mean, in the sense that one has a resentment towards somebody, and when one's thoughts keep circling around and around that person, just learning how to not allow somebody who one has aversion towards to hijack one's consciousness. And one recognizes that one has resentment or aversion, but that sense of constantly going back and chewing over the ill will and anger that one has is kind of masochistic.
In my own personal practice, equanimity, I often use the owner of your karma and the inheritor karma, so the question like, may I buy a own being? There seems to be a distinction here between equanimity as a practice and the reflection on karma.
How?
Well, because it's less, metta, karuna, upekkha, and then ignoring the person and then
right. Well, I mean, I think these are different alternatives as opposed to some progressive. I think whatever works, in the sense of dealing with a person that one has aversion towards. So it's not really a progressive practice. Whereas if one's developing the Brahma Viharas, then, you know, one is using the Brahma Viharas, and generally one would be trying to move towards equanimity as a goal. And I think whereas when dealing with this is just practical advice in dealing with aversion and ill will, and equanimity is a helpful tool because part of aversion and ill will, resentment is the kind of righteous indignation, and us getting on a kind of an inner rant, well, hopefully inner, inner rant on the, you know, what this, you know, how bad this person is, what this person should deserve and whatnot, it's not up to us at all, you know, in that sense of, and being able to just recognize that, these, whatever the case, the person will reap the fruits of their karma. And if I hold on to resentment and ill will, I will reap the fruits of my karma, which is aversion and ill will. It's not for all the righteous indignation that we can muster up. It doesn't. It actually doesn't undermine or negate that bad karma.
I'm wondering, sometimes the English translations we get of things, like how accurate those are sometimes.
Yeah.
So when we talk about the five hindrances, there's always like these antidotes to them.
Yeah.
And just that word antidote, because like, I've been contemplating, like, say, ill will.
Mm-hmm.
It's like when I have ill will rise in me, it's like, to me, it's like, I mean, just to switch to love of kindness doesn't really work. It's like, because I'm really filled with ill will.
Yeah.
Like, so doing this other practices, basically, you know, I try to just come back to this with my meditation, now coming back to equanimity, clearing the mind, and then. And establishing the loving kindness again.
Mm-hmm.
So I just heard about that word, you know, the antidote. Because it seems to me it's like if I develop loving kindness, it's actually like preventing the ill will from rising.
It depends. Again, it's sort of it's about what works as opposed to what is either doctrinally or ideally. How we idealize it or conceptualize it. It's more around what actually works. Maybe a counter would be a bet. But there's not going to be because it's a different concept in the sense of the word antidote or even countering. Because it's that makes it kind of black and white, the Buddha never really worked in those kind of black and white kind of categories. It was more around the what is it that actually works, and you know these are means of doing it. Especially this is a good. Kind of way oftentimes the classic one is the antidote to ill will is loving kindness, but what if it doesn't work? But here's a whole bunch of others that are useful for contemplation or experimenting with.
You use the word alternative a while back, and I really found that helpful.
Oh, alternative, okay. Yeah, sometimes I, because oftentimes it's like they're really sort of exploring the English language for alternatives of how to express an actual Dhamma concept.
Yeah, I just asked, I've just been kind of contemplating my earlier meditation instructions from retreats, and it always did sort of seem like this, you know, you have to get rid of that.
Right.
It seems more of understanding. It's more
right. Well, it's always always understanding is underlies the Buddha's teaching is so much dependent on, you know, wisdom. It's a wisdom teaching, and then there's all sorts of tools to experiment with and see if they actually are wise alternatives. Okay, so the next sutta is this is the one I was actually thinking of, or trying to think of. This is 162. There the Venerable Sariputta addressed the bhikkhus. Friends, bhikkhus. Friend, those bhikkhus replied. The Venerable Sariputta said this. Friends, there are these five ways of removing resentment by which a bhikkhu should entirely remove resentment when it has arisen toward anyone. What five? 1. Here a person's bodily behavior is impure, but his verbal behavior is pure. One should remove resentment toward such a person. 2. A person's verbal behavior is impure, but his bodily behavior is pure. One should also remove resentment toward such a person. 3. A person's bodily behavior and verbal behavior are impure, but from time to time he gains an opening of the mind, placidity of mind. One should also remove resentment toward such a person. 4. A person's bodily behavior and verbal behavior are impure, and he does not gain an opening of the mind, placidity of mind from time to time. One should also remove resentment toward such a person. 5. A person's bodily behavior and verbal behavior are pure, and from time to time he gains an opening of the mind, placidity of mind. One should also remove resentment towards such a person. Now that's more like outlining the different kinds of people there are, as opposed to pointing to the resentment. 1. How, friends, should resentment be removed toward the person whose bodily behavior is impure, but whose verbal behavior is pure? Suppose a rag-robed bhikkhu sees a rag by the roadside. He would press it down with his left foot, spread it out with his right foot, tear off an intact section, and take it away with him. So too, when a person's bodily behavior is impure, but his verbal behavior is pure, on that occasion one should not attend to the impurity of his bodily behavior, but should attend to the purity of his verbal behavior. In this way, resentment toward that person should be removed. I think what Sariputta, of course, is laying out is that people have many different characteristics and strengths and weaknesses and character qualities, learning how to pay attention to rather than paying attention to the things that are kind of coarse or inappropriate sometimes. Paying attention to what is actually pure and good about that person. That nobody's one dimensional. Just think of Ajahn Mahabhua's description of a particular senior monk who's not very not very skilled in his social skills were limited, say, so to speak. He said, he's like just pure gold, wrapped in shit.
So, yeah. With that analogy that he started to use there, is that like being aware of red robes is a beautiful thing, but the way he's sort of picking up the cloth is less beautiful.
Well, I think it's just that, yeah, there's a yeah, rag on a rag on the side of the road is probably not very clean, and so that one, rather than you sort of cautiously, rather than going in there dirtying your hands too much, you want to sort of deal with it in a way that is a bit more cautious. Okay, 2. How, friends, should resentment be removed toward the person whose verbal behavior is impure, but whose bodily behavior is pure? Suppose there is a pond covered with algae and water plants. A man might arrive, afflicted and oppressed by the heat, weary, thirsty, and parched. He would plunge into the pond, sweep away the algae and water plants with his hands, drink with his cupped hands, and then leave. So too, when a person's verbal behavior is impure, but his bodily behavior is pure, on that occasion one should not attend to the impurity of his verbal behavior, but should instead attend to the purity of his bodily behavior. In this way, resentment toward that person should be removed. 3. How, friends, should resentment be removed toward the person whose bodily behavior and verbal behavior are impure, but who from time to time gains an opening of the mind, placidity of mind? Suppose there is a little water in a puddle. Then a person might arrive, afflicted and oppressed by the heat, weary, thirsty, and parched. He would think, this little bit of water is in the puddle. If I try to drink it with my cupped hands or a vessel, I will stir it up, disturb it, and make it undrinkable. Let me get down on all fours, suck it up like a cow, and depart. He then gets down on all fours, sucks the water up like a cow, and departs. So too, when a person's bodily behavior and verbal behavior are impure, but from time to time he gains an opening of the mind, placidity of mind, on that occasion one should not attend to the impurity of his bodily and verbal behavior, but should instead attend to the opening of the mind, the placidity of mind, he gains from time to time. In this way, resentment toward that person should be removed. How, friends, should resentment be removed toward the person whose bodily and verbal behavior are impure and who does not gain an opening of the mind, placidity of mind, from time to time? Suppose a sick, afflicted, gravely ill person was traveling along a highway, and the last village behind him and the next village ahead of him were both far away. He would not attain suitable food and medicine or a qualified attendant. He would not get to meet the leader of the village district. Another man traveling along the highway might see him and arouse sheer compassion, sympathy, and tender concern for him, thinking, oh, may this man obtain suitable food, suitable medicine, and a qualified attendant. May he get to meet the leader of the village district. For what reason? So that this man does not encounter calamity and disaster right here. So too, when a person's bodily and verbal behavior are impure, and he does not gain from time to time an opening of the mind, placidity of mind, on that occasion one should arouse sheer compassion, sympathy, and tender concern for him, thinking, oh, may this venerable one abandon bodily misbehavior and develop good bodily behavior. May he abandon verbal misbehavior and develop good verbal behavior. May he abandon mental misbehavior and develop good mental behavior. For what reason? So that, with the breakup of the body after death, he will not be reborn in the plane of misery, in a bad destination, in the lower world, in hell. In this way, resentment toward that person should be removed. How, friends, should resentment be removed toward the person whose bodily and verbal behavior are pure, and who from time to time gains an opening of the mind, placidity of mind? Suppose there were a pond with clear, sweet, cool water, clean with smooth banks, a delightful place shaded by various trees. Then a man might arrive, afflicted and oppressed by the heat, weary, thirsty, and parched. Having plunged into the pond, he would bathe and drink. And then, after coming out, he would sit or lie down in the shade of a tree right there. So too, when a person's bodily and verbal behavior are pure, and from time to time he gains an opening of the mind, placidity of mind, on that occasion, one should attend to his pure bodily behavior, to his pure verbal behavior, and to the opening of the mind, the placidity of mind, that he gains from time to time. In this way, resentment toward that person should be removed. Friends, by means of a person who inspires confidence in every way, the mind gains confidence. These, friends, are the five ways of removing resentment, by means of which a bhikkhu can entirely remove resentment toward whomever it has arisen. So. Any questions on that?
Is there a note on gaining placidity of mind?
Well, I think it's that where the person does, you know, gets, you know, is peaceful, gets clear, and it's sort of clear in this last bit of the that the person has, has a pure mental behavior, so that they're somebody who has done some kind of training. I'll take a look at the footnote. It's pretty straightforward from the commentary. From time to time, he gains an opening of the mind, that is, an opportunity arises in his mind for serenity and insight, and he gains placidity, which consists in the achievement of faith. I could have figured that out. okay. And there's. Okay, so this next sutta that I found was more on the reasons not to bother with anger, not to get caught up in ill will and aversion. With the, you know, the dangers involved. Okay. This is from the Book of the Sevens in the Anguttara Sutta number 64. Bhikkhus, there are these seven things that are gratifying and advantageous to an enemy that come upon an angry man or woman. What seven? 1. Here, bhikkhus, an enemy wishes for an enemy. May he be ugly. For what reason? An enemy does not delight in the beauty of an enemy. When an angry person is overcome and oppressed by anger, though he may be well bathed, well anointed, with trimmed hair and beard, dressed in white clothes, still he is ugly. This is the first thing, gratifying and advantageous to an enemy that comes upon an angry man or woman. 2. Again, an enemy wishes for an enemy. May he sleep badly. For what reason? An enemy does not delight when an enemy sleeps well. When an angry person is overcome and oppressed by anger, though he may sleep on a couch, spread with rugs, blankets, and covers, with an excellent covering of antelope hide, with a canopy and red bolsters at both ends, still he sleeps badly. This is the second thing gratifying and advantageous to an enemy that comes upon an angry man or woman. 3. Again, an enemy wishes for an enemy. May he not succeed. For what reason? An enemy does not delight in the success of an enemy. When an angry person is overcome and oppressed by anger, if he gets what is harmful, he thinks, I've got what is beneficial. And if he gets what is beneficial, he thinks, I have gotten what is harmful. When, overcome by anger, he gets these things that are diametrically opposed, they lead to his harm and suffering for a long time. This is the third thing, gratifying and advantageous to an enemy that comes upon an angry man or woman. 4. Again, an enemy wishes for an enemy. May he not be wealthy. For what reason? An enemy does not delight in the wealth of an enemy. When an angry person is overcome and oppressed by anger, kings appropriate for the royal treasury any wealth he has acquired by energetic striving, amassed by the strength of his arms, earned by the sweat of his brow, righteous wealth righteously gained. This is the fourth thing, gratifying and advantageous to an enemy that comes upon an angry man or woman. 5. Again, an enemy wishes for an enemy. May he not be famous? For what reason? An enemy does not delight in the fame of an enemy. When an angry person is overcome and oppressed by anger, he loses whatever fame he had acquired through heedfulness. This is the fifth thing, gratifying and advantageous to an enemy that comes upon an angry man or woman. 6. Again, an enemy wishes for an enemy. May he have no friends? For what reason? An enemy does not delight in an enemy having friends. When an angry person is overcome and oppressed by anger, his friends and companions, relatives and family members avoid him from afar. This is the sixth thing, gratifying and advantageous to an enemy that comes upon an angry man or woman. 7. Again, an enemy wishes for an enemy. With the breakup of the body after death, may he be reborn in the plane of misery, in a bad destination, in the lower world, in hell. For what reason? An enemy does not delight in an enemy's going to a good destination. When an angry person is overcome and oppressed by anger, he engages in misconduct by body, speech, and mind. As a consequence, still overcome by anger, with the breakup of the body after death, he is reborn in the place of misery, in a bad destination, in the lower world, in hell. This is the seventh thing, gratifying and advantageous to an enemy that comes upon an angry man or woman. These are the seven things gratifying and advantageous to an enemy that come upon an angry man or woman. And then it finishes, actually a bit long, verses. The angry person is ugly. He also sleeps badly. Having gained some benefit, he takes it to be harmful. The angry person, overcome by anger, having slain by body and speech, incurs the loss of wealth. Maddened by anger, he acquires a bad reputation. His relatives, friends, and loved ones avoid the angry person. Anger is a cause of harm. Anger stirs up mental turmoil. People do not recognize the peril that has arisen from within. The angry person doesn't know the good. The angry person doesn't see the Dhamma. There is just blindness and dense gloom when anger overcomes a person. When an angry person causes damage, whether easily or with difficulty, later, when the anger has vanished, he is tormented as if burnt by fire. He shows recalcitrance as a fire does a smoky cress. When his anger spreads outward, people become angry on his account. He has no shame or fear of wrong. His speech is not respectful. One overcome by anger has no island of safety at all. I will tell you about the deeds that produce torment. Listen to them as they are, remote from those that are righteous. And then it goes into all the different things that angry people do, and it's mostly around taking life. Angry person slays his father, slays his mother, a Brahmin, worldly. Those beings, like oneself, each hold their self most dear. Yet those who are angry kill themselves in various ways when they are distraught about diverse matters. Some kill themselves with a sword. Some who are distraught swallow poison. Some hang themselves with a rope. Some jump into a mountain gorge. Deeds that involve destroying growth and deeds that cause their own death. When doing such deeds, they do not know that defeat is born of anger. Thus, death's snare hidden in the heart has taken the form of anger. One should cut it off by self-control, wisdom, energy, and right view. The wise person should eradicate this one unwholesome quality. In such a way, one should train in the Dhamma. Do not yield to recalcitrance. Free from anger, their misery gone, free from delusion, no longer avid, tamed, having abandoned anger, the taintless ones attain Nibbana. Any questions on that? Let's see here. quite vivid, as can sometimes be the case in the Buddha's. Okay? Yeah.
Question. Oftentimes, when the description of five minutes is ill will, seems to be used in my memory, always concerned with people, relationship between people.
Right.
So I was wondering, in terms of five minutes, does ill will also cover just aversion, like more basic aversions, even to like frustrations or aversion to, you know, feelings of discomfort or things like that? Or is that like a different difference?
I think I think it's illustrated through relationship to people, but I think any form of ill will manifests in negativity, that sense of agitation that comes through, because the image that the Buddha uses, two images, both images that the Buddha uses to illustrate the effect of ill will. One in the terms of the image of water, then it's the water that's boiling, so that the water that is pure, as we say, one can, is settled and still and clear, and one can see one's reflection in it. When it's boiling, then it's agitated and one can't see. So whether it's directed externally or whether it's just sort of an internal irritation, it's still that water is agitated. And same with the illustration that the Buddha uses when he compares to ill will being like a person who is ill, afflicted by a fever or illness, and they're not able to enjoy their food, not able to get settled. So that wherever the direction is, that effect is still there. And so that illustration gives a good sense of what the effect of any kind of ill will is.